Green Shake, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. Happy to be with you today. It is July the 7th, 2017, our first show in July, and looks like a hot, humid day after a little bit of rain last night. And that's the weather report. One of my great heroes is actually Chris in the Morning. Of course, he's a fictional hero. He was a character that was featured in a TV series that is not able to, you're not able to binge watch it anywhere right now, but hopefully it's going to come back. It's having a resurgence in interest. It is called Northern Exposure. That was the Northern Exposure theme song that we used for many years here for this show, actually. And then we got more modern with the Bones theme. The whole idea of Northern Exposure was it's a small town, but it has big ideas every week. And in each episode, their DJ on the only radio station in town, who was not only Chris in the Morning, but he often did afternoon shows, late night shows. He was the only DJ on a regular basis. And his DJ name, therefore, whenever he was on the air, was Chris in the Morning, since that was his key show. He'd start everybody in the town of 800-some off with a review of what's happening and the events for the day and some interesting philosophical thoughts, too, because Chris in the Morning was self-educated and he had done a lot of reading in philosophy and literature, and it was very interesting to follow that show for the ideas. And it really was an excellent series. It lasted 6 years. The episodes are available on DVD. I just happen to have a collection of them myself, and I started watching them because there was nothing else on, 100,000 channels and nothing on, that situation. Great shows from the past are still great. There's many I could name them, but this show was on CBS from, as I said, 1990 to 1995, and it's only available if you want to buy DVDs. And the box set now is getting expensive because it's becoming sort of a collector's item, I think. Nonetheless, some of the big ideas we're going to touch on in today's show, because we talk about local issues, local events, and some alternative views, too, just to get you thinking and to allow you to come to your own conclusions after you're, jolted a little bit. So any opinions you hear on the show are, today, mine, or at least relayed to you by me. And all these ideas are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College, not faculty, staff, students, or administrators, or Board of Trustee members. It's always important to say, too. But we thank them for their continued support of a forum that tries to be fair and balanced, but also a little bit stimulating, too, at the time. So we don't pick favorites. We don't have an edge here, but we do give some ideas out that you can either accept or reject. Well, what about stories?
Well, there's quite a few. Oh, my goodness, that we didn't cover.
For example, from June the 29th, not too much more than a week ago, plus one day. But in the Metro Times, the Detroit Metro Times issue from last week, or on their website anyway, Attorney General Bill Schuette calls for Line 5, that's the gas line that's running under Lake Michigan, somewhere by the bridge up there that ties our two peninsulas together. And it's pretty old, 60 years old, and although a report that was commissioned and a draft analysis was released, which said, and it's got to be crazy, right? It said that, and of course that contracts had, it turns out that the people who did it had conflict of interest. In other words, they had interest in the project and therefore their opinions could be swayed. So it wasn't exactly an impartial study. But they said that the Line 5, which has been in operation since 1953, you can add that up if you want to, that's 64 years, could operate indefinitely. Well, you know that's bogus. Indefinitely means pretty much forever. And I was an English teacher for 14 years, so I kind of know the meaning of words. And that's just bogus. It's just wrong. Stuff wears out. Stuff falls apart. That's happening around my house, I know. In fact, the city of Dearborn is replacing my street for the second time in 20 years. Of course, they're all also replacing water mains. And the gas company was under there changing their piping, that is the natural gas DTE people, from metal to PVC, polyvinyl chloride. Not good for the environment, but it doesn't biodegrade. So it's good for a while, I guess. But it's interesting that, you know, stuff wears out, but in all situations. But this report, which is kind of bogus and must have been biased because the contract was terminated on June 21st, but it said that the line could operate indefinitely. Well, Attorney General Schuette, who is, of course, running for, everybody knows, he hasn't directly said it yet, I guess, hasn't started his campaign officially, he's running for governor. Governor Snyder is term limited. And so next year, 2018, we'll go through the process of trying to elect a new governor, not this November, but a year from this November. And of course, Schuette wants to sound like he's doing things for the people. So he actually issued a report. And the headline on the Metro Times article says he's calling for Line 5 shutdown after the scrapped risk analysis report. Well, he didn't. No, if you read the story, I mean, I don't know who makes up these headlines. Usually editors do. What he called for was that there should be a specific indefinite timeline for the shutdown. Well, that could be 20, 30 years, 50 years. I mean, yeah, of course there has to be a timeline, and things have to be done along the way, and he's right at pointing that out. Some people in the Upper Peninsula need propane, and I guess the pipeline has something to do with carrying propane, too. But he also wants a legislative ban on heavy crude and tar sands oil, it's oil actually, being transported through the straits. Yeah, that's right. Whether it's in boats or through a pipeline or whatever, that's dangerous too, just about as bad as this Line 5. And also call to maintain energy jobs provided by the pipeline. Well, we should try to maintain jobs for everybody, right? So if the pipeline is shut down, five or six people are going to be out of work, I guess, and we'll have to find something else for them to do. You would think that would be the responsibility of Enbridge, the Canadian company that owns and maintains, supposedly maintains Line 5. But he also is proposing that, oh, somebody should build an underground tunnel under Lake Michigan, up there at the Straits, as an alternative. Well, what does he know about that? I mean, how expensive will that be to dig under the lakeway there? And is that going to last any longer? Is that going to last 50 years or 100 years? Just because it's under dirt, under the lake bed, doesn't necessarily mean to me that it's going to avoid corrosion. or even damage for that sort. I don't know, but I think that's crazy. As stated by David Holtz, who's the current chair of Sierra Club Michigan chapter, and that's an organization which I support, and I'm a member of Sierra Club, proudly a member of Sierra Club among other nonprofits, but Michigan chapter especially. They do a great job in lobbying our legislators to give us a clean environment, because I don't think they would unless somebody was lobbying them in the right direction and explaining why that's necessary, if you need an explanation. And apparently our legislators in the majority anyway, they do. But David Holtz said very clearly, oil pipelines do not belong in the Great Lakes. And this pipeline, which is called Line 5, is more than 6 decades old and runs a constant risk of failure. And also, I was looking at the website, which I happen to have up on the screen on our Mac computer here in the studio. And again, you can go there anytime yourself, of course, but you wouldn't get all the additional opinions and insights from yours truly, michiganradio.org. Their lead story under the news heading is that public meetings are starting over new report on Enbridge's Line 5. New public meetings begin Thursday. That was yesterday, about the controversial Enbridge Line 5 pipeline. And the details are that that Dynamic Risk Assessment Systems, that's a different company than before, gives 6 options for dealing with the decades-old pipelines. The protesters, however, who gathered ahead of the meeting yesterday, said there's only one option: shut it down. And this is a comment from a woman, Jessica Fujan, of Food and Water Watch. I've heard of them. Food and Water Watch, Michigan nonprofit, says, is not serving the public, but is endangering drinking water for millions of people. That's Line 5. She says, we want to see Line 5 shut down and transition to 100% renewable energy. We don't need the gas and the oil. It is now cheaper to build, and this is a job sort of thing, build the various infrastructure we need for solar and wind power. And David Holtz is quoted again in that article, too. So this is a very current issue. And it matters to us. Why here in the Detroit area? Because if the lakes are polluted by Line 5, then we can't drink the water, even down here, because it won't just stay up at the Straits. It's going to spread throughout, and it's going to be a terrible disaster. And so it's important to think rationally about Enbridge Line 5 pipeline. And this is the comment from Jack Lessenberry from Michigan Public Radio about that very same thing. So listen up. Here's Jack Lessenberry.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. For the 4th of July, former Michigan Attorney General Frank Kelly invited me to watch fireworks from the porch of the captain's quarters overlooking the harbor on Mackinac Island. From there, I could see fireworks simultaneously from Sheboygan and Mackinac City, in addition to those being fired from a barge not far offshore from the island. That was a show, but a few hours later, looking out at that beautiful expanse of water, I couldn't help thinking about what I couldn't see under the surface. 2 oil pipelines under the straits between Lakes Michigan and Huron, collectively known as Line 5, capable of carrying as much as 540,000 gallons of oil a day. Enbridge Energy, the Texas-based firm that owns them, believes they're perfectly safe. And last week, the state of Michigan released a report that said Line 5 could operate into the foreseeable future. The report was done by a company with a curious name, Dynamic Risk. Now, it's nice to know that they think Line 5 is safe, but not especially reassuring. For one thing, Enbridge thought its oil pipeline near the Kalamazoo River was safe before 6 feet of it ruptured 7 years ago this month. The resulting spill took years and cost more than $1 billion to clean up. It's also worth noting that when the spill set off alarm bells at Enbridge, workers didn't realize at first that a pipe had broken. They thought it was only blocked, and to try and clear the pipe, they increased pressure and pumped more oil into the spill. Earlier this year, Senator Gary Peters told me he'd asked the Coast Guard whether they could deal with a Line 5 break. The answer was no. talking purely conservative common sense here. There's no way any sane government should tolerate something that could easily destroy two of the greatest lakes in the world. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette has something in common with Line 5. Both came into the world in 1953, 64 years ago. Now, Schuette has called for the pipeline to be shut down under a specific and definite timetable, which sounds very good, especially if you're running for governor, which he is. But it also sounds like a friend of mine who will cheerfully tell you that, yes, he needs to diet and start exercising, and that he intends to do exactly that. Yet he won't commit to a date when he'll start. Nor will Schuette offer a date by which time Line 5 should no longer be in service. Now, a number of environmental groups have said the Attorney General has the legal power to shut it down now. Bill Schuette has not, to the best of my knowledge, weighed in on that. But we should demand that he or any other politician wanting statewide office say exactly what they do with Line 5 and when. The dynamic risk analysis they gave the state also presents several well-thought-out safer options, complete with costs. We need to pick one. A major oil spill in the Great Lakes would be the one thing our environment and our economy might never overcome. So, the bottom line is that this is one place we can't afford to play politics. It's really as simple as that.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
And there you go. So, if you want to make your voice known on this issue, you know, you'll have to look at where, first of all, if you actually want to go and testify somewhere, these these feedback sessions, whatever, are held all across Michigan. I don't think there's anything local that's coming up, but I didn't click on that link for you. Certainly support the watchdog groups that I mentioned that are trying to save us from ourselves, and that would be Sierra Club Michigan Chapter and Food and Watch, Food and Water Watch. So you can search those on the internet and see what you can find out there. Just following up, also a story that came last week. I was going to mention that Flint, and you probably heard this on the major news networks, that Flint City Council decided not to approve a long-term water deal. Some of the members of the City Council up there were not sure about some of the details. And now the state of Michigan is suing Flint after all the trouble caused by the state of Michigan to Flint, but they're suing Flint over failing to approve a long-term water deal. That happened on June 28th in federal court over its failure to approve a long-term drinking water source for residents. Flint switched its water supply in 2014, sparking a crisis linked to an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease and at least 12 deaths, as well as exposure of residents to dangerously high lead levels. Since October 2015, the city has obtained its water from the Great Lakes Water Authority. But the Flint City Council's refusal this week to approve a long-term agreement with the supplier, negotiated by the city's mayor without proposing a reasonable alternative, will, quote, cause an imminent and substantial endangerment to public health in Flint, unquote, according to the lawsuit filed by the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, also known as MDEQ, in district court in Detroit. I'm glad the state has lawyers that they can pay money to take care of this. The state is asking the court to bar Flint from changing water sources and adopting a long-term agreement. I do believe, if it says here, the Great Lakes Water Authority is the one that routes through the Detroit. That's the water we get here in Dearborn. But remember that Flint residents are paying more for water than any other city in the United States, and it's still not safe to drink. Which is why a lot of people up there have refused to pay. Some just decide not to pay anyway, or they don't have money to pay, but nonetheless, you know, is it a public right to have water? Is that a public right? Should you have to pay for water? Well, pay for the use of water, okay. You know, if you use more water, then maybe you should pay more, but I understand that. But, you know, and they did have some sort of, just like they did in Detroit, some sort of chance for people to suspend payment. They should suspend it totally. If it's not safe to drink, the state of Michigan should pay for the water. That's my opinion. Okay? And they should pay for the fix, too. since it's largely people who were employed by the state of Michigan that made the bad decisions. A lot of them are now up on criminal charges. But who's going to take care of Flint in the meantime? You know, yes, I know the state of Michigan legislature has given $100 million, $200 million, whatever, towards, you know, bringing in bottled water and trying to do other things. Well, they're not doing enough, in my opinion. This is known, this disaster is known not just throughout the U.S., but around the world. Around the world. And it's definitely a public disgrace. It's a horrible community shame and a national shame, too. And, of course, as we found out, Flint isn't the only city in the United States that's got this problem or related problem of giving its residents bad water and charging a lot for it on top of that. I thought there was a plan in this article from the Arab American News from last week. I thought there was a plan to get their water from Lake Huron further north, but they would have to build some sort of extension pipes in order to do that, which would cost a lot of money. But I know that I go to eat sometimes. I take a trip to beautiful Flint. I go there for a few hours, a couple months from a statewide meeting with a group that I'm a member of. And this restaurant is on the east side of Flint, and they get their water from Lake Huron. So they don't use the contaminated water. If they did, they'd be out of business because they couldn't provide water for cooking or for drinking at the tables if they didn't bring it in huge tank trailers or tank vehicles. I don't know how close the Lake Huron water supply is, which would originate, I guess, in Port Huron. Port Huron probably uses the water supply from Lake Huron, wherever the central facility is in Port Huron or nearby. They don't use the Detroit water, the Great Lakes Authority, in my understanding. And I thought that was going to be one of the plans. But since it was easier to switch back to the clean water, not the dirty water coming out of the Flint River, which caused the pipes to corrode, but just go back to the water from Detroit, which is pumped up to them. So I don't know why there wasn't an alternative suggested. But the mayor said, while disappointing in this, that the state and federal government are now involved in making a decision, we as city leaders should be making for that we as city leaders should be making for Flint. I cannot say that I am surprised at this lawsuit. And she added that her plan was the best option, but the city council wanted to hear some other options. And because they didn't. Well, anyway, City Council President Kerry Nelson told the Detroit News that the state's June 26 deadline was too rushed for council members who needed more time to examine the deal. On Wednesday, Governor Snyder, this is last week, and state officials called on the council to approve the mayor's deal. Snyder spokeswoman Anita Heaton said the city is well on its way to a full recovery. I think it's at least 3 years away from what I've read. And to hinder that progress now would be a major and costly setback for residents. Okay, well, that's the update on that. And we need clean water, folks. And it's everybody's, I think it should be everybody's right. And the water shouldn't cost very much. I know we have to operate the, not just getting clean water to the residents and making sure it's clean, but also sewage treatment. A big cost of the so-called water systems is also sewage systems. And when we flush that toilet, it's got to go somewhere, and it's got to be treated. It can't just go raw sewage, can't go right back into our water supply to contaminate it. And that's a big deal. Okay. We should be on top of that. Good. All right. Another top story for the day here on the new WHFR Journal on WHFR.FM. Alternative views and news for Dearborn and the surrounding area, Dearborn, Michigan, and surrounding area. If you're listening from out of state, on our website, WHFR.FM. It's about the car industry. I think I mentioned last week that Ford Motor Company has decided to build all of the Ford Focus vehicles, its small car, for the whole world in China. And they're going to be closing a plant in Wayne, Michigan, and redirecting it, refurbishing it so it builds pickup trucks and other cars that will give more money to the high labor costs of the United States, give them more profit that way. And so supposedly no jobs are going to be lost in that transition. But this is from the New York Times from just a couple days ago, July 5th, front page. Carmakers cut American jobs as sales slump. Here's the story. After a prolonged recovery that culminated in 2 years of record sales, the American auto industry is slowing down. Automakers said sales dropped in June for a sixth consecutive month, falling by 3% from a year ago. As demand falls, there's less work in the nation's assembly plants. Last year, those plants hit a peak of 11,000 workers. Yeah. 200 people doing the job for the whole U.S. Well, this is amazing to me. It's only 211,000 workers in the whole U.S. working at auto plants. And they don't say it's just in Michigan. Now, that happens to be a 55% increase since the depths of the recession in 2019. So it was only, what, 100,000? Well, again, that number from the peak, it's dropped by more than 2% so far this year to 206,000 workers in April. A statement from a manufacturing consultant, Ron Harbor, said that there's been a consistent reduction in plant output in the last 6 months, and what is ahead in the next 6 months could be pretty startling. The decline signals at least a pause in Detroit's resurgence from the dark days of the financial crisis. It's happening despite President Trump's promises to pressure automakers to save and create good-paying American factory jobs. Industry analysts said consumers might be pulling back on spending because of tighter credit conditions and more expensive vehicle loans. The impact on employment is uneven, however, reflecting the evolving tastes of American car buyers. With low gas prices motivating buyers to trade in traditional cars for larger models, factories making trucks and sport utility vehicles are humming. Even as overall vehicle sales declined in June, sales of trucks and SUVs rose about 4% from a year earlier. And of course, all of you who are taking that option, that doesn't make any sense unless you need a truck or an SUV for your business purposes, that no other vehicle will work. I know it's big, it's macho, it's flashy, and it's the biggest selling trucks, pickup trucks especially, individual car type in the whole United States of America. Not because we need them, but because we want to add to our image. They're not as economical to run, either we're talking gasoline or maintenance or repair. They take up more space on the roads and they pollute the air more. So give us a break. I'm sorry, those of you who love your pickups, give us a break. Try to find something more appropriate. I think I've mentioned that I own a Ford Edge, 2016. And it's gas economy around town. When I got it, something happened, but I've driven it more now, has declined to 19 miles to a gallon. It just uses regular. And it's relatively clean because it was a 2016 model, so it has all the accoutrements to make it clean according to current standards, of course. But that's crazy. 19 miles to a gallon? In fact, I have a second car. And I don't drive them equally, so you can't say that's outrageous. I have a sports car. That gets 22 miles to a gallon around town. Give me a break. And it's got a V6 engine in it. Is it lighter weight? No, it's the same weight as the Edge. Oh, something's got to change there. Every year I try to find a car that's more economical to run and less polluting. And I think I'm getting close to the point of buying an all-electric car. The hybrids aren't exactly for me for a number of reasons. Might just go all the way next time around. And what they say is a conclusion to the New York Times article from this last Wednesday, July 5th, what none of the automakers are doing is building new plants or adding a significant number of new jobs anytime soon. And a commentary from MichiganRadio.org must have read the same New York Times article. Even though that unemployment has fallen nationally to 4.7%, the lowest in a quarter century, it's actually an ominous sign, says the story, of trouble ahead. The article used in the New York Times about unemployment, so it wasn't the one I just read, used employment data to suggest that while almost everyone who wants to be employed is currently employed, millions of high-skilled, strategically essential jobs are going unfilled. More so, the new xenophobia is making it increasingly difficult to import talent from other countries. Nowhere is this talent gap more challenging than the automotive industry. A recent Business Week story says it all, and the title is, Detroit is trying really hard to woo young workers. That's the story in Business Week. It points out that the lack of qualified new hires has become so pressing that now part of the weekly executive briefing at General Motors. That's what they're talking about at General Motors' top offices. How do they get the qualified people new hires? And at this year's Mackinac Island Policy Conference, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder highlighted the need to train, recruit, and retain proficient young engineers and other professionals if Detroit-based companies hope to win the connected technology and autonomous vehicle race, which is a bad trend, I think, that autonomous thing. But anyway. Story goes on to say, as the baby boomers who created the post-war economy retire, yeah, I was one of those. I was born after World War II. In ever-increasing numbers, the ramifications are clear and unsettling. If America hopes to keep its prized position as the innovation leader of the world in key industries such as automotive and aerospace, and keep the standard of living that goes with them, it had better find a way to quickly develop the competencies required to advance technologies faster than its competitors. And they talk about the specter of a new innovation leader, China. Less than 3 years ago, then-Vice President Joe Biden quipped, I challenge you, name me one innovative project, one innovative change, one innovative product that has come out of China, unquote. Well, anyone who attended this year's Consumer Electronics Show can probably name a dozen. Industrial robots, 3D printing, and various types of consumer prosthetics, to name just a few. And these aren't even close to the whole story. Chinese advances in material science, naval engineering, and deep space satellite killers are all currently considered issues of national security. Because China is spending money on research and development. And the patents awarded for innovations have significantly outpaced our own. And there's books you can read if you want to find out the details on that. And the article goes on. I'm not going to continue that at this point on the show. But that's MichiganRadio.org, always full of great stories and news every day. Yes, and you can go there for podcasts, too, if you here in Dearborn can't listen to their programming, which is carried a great deal, but not all the time, on WUOM in Ann Arbor. I wanted to mention a story from car.com. We're talking about cars, so here we go. What are the 2017's top most American cars? If you want to buy an all-American car anymore, you can't. Sorry. But cars are bits and pieces from here and there all over the world. It is definitely a global market. And what they had to do from a previous most American car rating at car.com, whether it was 2016 or whatever, they had to change the criteria because they were winding up without really many American cars at all. You know, all American, because they're not all American. As I mentioned several times, my Ford Edge is made in Oakville, beautiful Oakville. Not Indiana or Illinois, like my dealership here in Dearborn told me, but it's in Ontario, Canada, just outside on the west side of Toronto. Every time I go to Toronto, I wave to the factory, birthplace of that car. So here's the list, if you're interested. And they have like 16 different criteria, so I'm sure you might have questions. Well, why wasn't this car, I know it was made in America. Well, it's a matter of the content, too, okay? And several different criteria. So you have to go to car.com to read the criteria, but they're trying to be fair in this case. And I read all the criteria, and I think I understand most of them. The number one most American car in terms of manufacturing, you know, where it is assembled and the bits and pieces, is the Jeep Wrangler out of Toledo, Ohio. Number two, the Jeep Cherokee, you know, with the one with the little slanty eyes for headlights. That's made in Toledo, Ohio, also in Belvidere, Illinois. Okay, number three is Ford Taurus, that big, lumbering, uneconomical dinosaur that Ford has for their big four-door sedan. I'm sorry. They haven't updated that in years, and it's big and heavy and uneconomical, but it's made in Chicago. Number four, interestingly, is Honda Ridgeline. That's a pickup. You know, I criticize pickup trucks. Well, there are some pickup trucks that are very economical to run. And, you know, smaller ones. Does the Ford still have the Ranger model? I guess it does. That would be because it's lighter weight. And it looks like a pickup, but it, you know, maybe it's a little more economical. But the Honda Ridgeline is more U.S., by this criteria from car.com, than the Ford F-150, which is the largest selling car in the United States. It's a pickup. And the Honda Ridgeline is made in Lincoln, not Nebraska, Lincoln, Alabama. There's more than one Lincoln in this country, I guess. Number five on the list of most American car is the Acura RDX. It's a small four-door sedan. That's made in East Liberty, Ohio, which is also where the Accord is made. But that's not on the top 10 list here, because I guess they have different parts that come from more places around the world, even though it is assembled in East Liberty, Ohio. I'm fairly sure it is. Number six is the Ford F-150 that I mentioned. That's made in Dearborn, but also Clay Como, Missouri. The Ford Expedition, which is another dinosaur, monster car, truck. It's an SUV, I know. I thought Ford said they were going to get rid of it. But oh no, people want the big cars. Okay, Louisville, Kentucky. Eight, GMC Acadia. That's a fairly big size SUV. That's made in Spring Hill, Tennessee, the former home of Saturn, which is a great idea. Really was. And again, GM, who also came up with a great electric, all-electric car in the 90s, didn't know what the heck they were doing. And, Saturn is an example, and if it succeeds, it'll spread. Well, they never supported it properly. And so it didn't spread, and now they're using that factory for big honking SUVs, like the GMC Acadia. Number nine, Honda Odyssey. Lincoln, Alabama again. Number 10, Honda Pilot. That's a big SUV, three-seater, I believe. Very square, boxy. That's also from Lincoln, Alabama. Now, you know, most Fiat Chrysler automobiles are made in Canada. The Dodge Viper, are they still making that? The big $80,000-plus sports car, which is, it's in its last year. I thought that was made on the east side of Detroit, as is the Jeep Grand Cherokee. But apparently a lot of parts for that come from outside of America. It's not on the list. I was wondering, what about the Acura MDX? The RDX is there, but the MDX is their SUV. But again, it must have different parts coming to different places. What about that Chevy Corvette? I thought that was made, wasn't it, Bowling Green or Louisville or somewhere down there, Ohio, Kentucky, whatever. But that isn't in the top 10 either. So do these things really matter? I don't think so. I think you have to go for the best car that's appropriate these days for the environment, for your specific needs, not more than your needs, but just your needs, not your wants so much, although sometimes you can get what you want as well as what you need for about the same price. That's cool, right? But we've got to be concerned about not saving money, but also saving the planet. And just thought I'd read that list to you, which is completely, really not relevant anymore. Notice that Ford Mustang is not on that list either. But they're assembled in Flat Rock still, aren't they?
I think so.
But where are the parts coming from? Okay. And how many workers are involved in making them? I think one criteria that I read on car.com was how many human beings are actually involved in the assembly. compared to how many robots? Okay, because the more human beings means more workers, American workers, are benefiting from the assembling of the putting together of these vehicles. But if it's all done by robots, there's no U.S. jobs there. So we lose that economic turnaround.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Well, it's about 22 minutes to the end of the hour today on the new WHFR Journal, WHFR.FM, the station making waves. For those that are listeners, also overnight, our classical 24 programming has been interrupted on and off the last several weeks. And that's because we were having trouble with our satellite dish and the feed, that is the signal line coming in from it. And we couldn't find an engineer locally, even after I searched the internet for 4 hours, who would want to come and take the job. Because they claimed that our National Public Radio C-band dish, which is about 3 meters in 4 meters in diameter, is old technology. Shame on them. And all they know how to do is put up a little KU dish for like Dish TV or DirecTV, and it's just plug and play. I mean, it's, yeah, they got to point it in the right direction at the right satellite, but they're not engineers. They're installers, but they're people that don't know how anything works. They just plug the wire into the dish, point the dish, bolt it down to the roof or whatever, and leave. Finally, I was able to find an engineer recommended by National Public Radio, and thank you very much for that help. Of course, we pay for their help. They gave us a whole new dish system 4 years ago, but things happen, you know, and you need help. While I was searching for, and this relates to the last story, while I was searching for a satellite engineering company that handled these large dishes, and every public radio station, over 6,000 of us in the U.S., uses the same dishes for satellite communication and satellite programming, including WDET in Detroit, FM in Detroit, and also WEMU and so on. There's a desperate need for satellite system engineers, or microwave consultants, if you want to call it that. And there's want ads that I found in that 4 hours of satellite searching. We want to hire you, all kinds of companies. And I said, I better put my want ad out there too, that it's a part-time job, and we just want to get this thing fixed. But who is out there? I found finally on my own somebody in Chicago. Well, that would have cost $1,000 just to get them over here in the Detroit area, even before they try to work on it. This morning, we had an engineer. We discovered an engineer, thanks to NPR, his company is out in Chelsea, Michigan. I won't mention the name. It's not a time. I'm not doing an ad for them. But here's another thing, that radio stations have digital and analog electronic equipment, including satellite dishes, and we don't have enough trained technicians available. You say, well, there's only, you know, these 5,000-6,000 public radio stations. No, almost all radio and TV stations have satellite dishes of one sort or another, big ones, not just the little direct TV dishes, plug and play, and communication networks, digital networks of all kinds, and people are needed, but you got to get educated. And you've got to know where the jobs are, too. It's easy enough to find out about, radio and TV engineers and satellite service engineers and higher paying jobs that this person goes for close to $100 an hour that came out. That's what the going rate is for a service call. Although I think last time I got a local plumber to come to my house, it was about $100 an hour too. Now it's $60, $70 an hour. But that's what a professional costs these days. And there's plenty of jobs. I don't know about plumbers, but plenty of jobs. One place or the other, maybe you have to drive, like this one engineer had to drive in from Chelsea, Michigan, who we paid for the cost of that trip, of course, back and forth. But I'm just saying, we've got the Satellite 24 up and running. Thank you very much. But we needed a satellite engineer. We were desperate for 2 weeks. And finally, through connections at National Public Radio, we finally found someone who is great and who fixed the problem quickly. So that's back on the air.
However,
I was looking at the last issue of our student newspaper, our college campus newspaper, which is put together by student staff with a staff supervisor and advisory staff too here. It's won some awards over the years. And they do publish, it's more like a magazine to me because they publish a lot of opinion pieces and social media criticism and so on. But I just opened it. It was the last issue for this year. And the title of the article is Going to College Really Your Best Option? Okay, here's a newspaper that's distributed only on this college campus of Henry Ford College, main campus, 5101 Evergreen in Dearborn. And it's an opinion piece. And just listen to the beginning. Any college student will tell you the financial baggage that comes with getting a degree is almost too much to handle. Students spend thousands of dollars a year to get higher education, only to end up finding themselves drowning in loans before they even have a job. The worst part? The article asks. Many of these students spend the rest of their lives spending the money they make on paying back their loans. Yeah, this is a crisis in our society. I've mentioned this before. Yes, I support the idea of free college tuition for any qualified student. Other countries of the world do this, but they're not spending half of their federal budget policing the world with all kinds of little war. We have six or seven countries that we're actually at war in right now. Are we making the world safer democracy? Are we making the world safer? Well, some of our leaders say we are. I'll get back to that in the remaining 15 minutes I have. But this is outrageous. I think it's over $1 trillion of debt, trillion and a half now, almost $2 trillion, that's owed by students who have gone to college. And they're trying to pay it off. You say, well, those deadbeats ought to pay it off. How can you do that and have a life? Because the debt in this case, there's a couple of students talked. They went to a big-time four-year school. 2 years into school, and I was $50,000 in debt. Now, that wouldn't happen, I don't think, here at Henry Ford, especially if you're commuting, you know, living at home or something. Obviously, community colleges, it's the greatest deal in the world. And especially since we have, and other colleges too, to a certain extent, we have great transfer arrangements. So every class you take, according to the list of transferable classes, and there's almost everything, but there are some things that don't transfer that easily or directly. See a counselor whenever you get to college. This is a great deal, I have to say. You know, I know I'm right here broadcasting from Henry Ford College, but what a great deal. It's the only sort of thing. Why should you burden yourself if you don't need to? Again, you can transfer from a two-year school to a four-year school, and you still get the degree from big-time school, whatever it is, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, or whatever you want. And so if you want to, you know, put out a little more money for the four-year school, get the four-year degree, you can do that. We do offer, you know, here at Henry Ford College, a four-year degree in culinary arts, hospitality and culinary arts. And we just started doing that last year, and we had our first graduates already. They got through at much less money, especially if they're still living at home or something and didn't have that room and board problem to pay for. So it's a big question, but is college really your best option? Absolutely. That's the answer to that one. The cost is terrible, but our society should do something about it. And with all the money we're spending on war and violence and weapon systems worldwide, well, guess what? It was the opinion of Donald J. Trump when he was campaigning for office that we didn't need that. We didn't need to be in 200 countries worldwide, that all that money could be redirected. We didn't need to be in all the wars we're involved in. He said outright that the Iraq War, he was talking about the most recent one, of course, wasn't necessary. There's no weapons of mass destruction. That was all a hoax, of a falsehood, misunderstanding. We shouldn't be there. We're not doing any good in Afghanistan anymore. We're not doing any good in Iraq. Yes, I know if we leave, there'll be some more people dying. But There's people dying everywhere. There's people dying in America from bad water. I'm sorry I have to bring that up again. But well, why did Trump win? Well, he was promising a lot of things, whether or not you heard this, but other than being, for, and the big statement I heard, of course, you're going to have the greatest health care. It's going to be, everybody's going to have health care. You're not going to lose Medicaid. You're not going to lose Medicare. We're going to have a health care system in which everybody is covered and the cost for health care will be less. And that's almost a direct quote from Donald J. Trump when he was campaigning. That was his promise all the way through, just like getting us out of all foreign wars and maybe redirecting that money. He didn't say anything himself about free tuition in college. That was Bernie Sanders. But many countries of the world that don't have this huge burden, 50% of the budget almost going, the federal budget, not going to healthcare, not going to research and development on science or energy solutions or anything that's really needed, in my humble opinion, more than it is now. But there is a study that was done, and this is reported on a website that I just became aware of, antiwar.com, that there was a study done, and they think that the swing difference in terms of issues on these few states that were close but put Trump into the victory column, as they say, in the Electoral College. Again, he didn't win the popular vote. But the difference, more significance than his promise about health care, either maintaining it or improving it or both, was getting us out of foreign wars, getting us out of 200 countries in the world with our military. And then, of course, you have a lot of extra money to do whatever you want to. You could build that wall against Mexico if you want to do that. But, we're talking about a huge chunk of our budget going to nothing that helps life, everything that hurts life, not just for the people that suffer and die on the other side of our weapons, but also including innocent people, which is going on all the time, it's collateral damage, I know. Yeah, right. Uh-huh. I don't go along with that. So anyway, it's interesting that they think that was that promise, which he also has gone back on and got much more in favor of war in a whole bunch of places since he's been elected president, as well as going back on his promise about maintaining Medicare and Medicaid and insuring everybody at much lower cost. That's not happening, obviously. And we'll find out what happens with health care this week in Congress in Washington, D.C. Okay, well, the reason I played the Northern Exposure theme at the beginning today was because on that show, as I've been watching these episodes from the early 90s and 1995, they have episodes all about environmentalism, maintaining the ecology and ecological balance. They have shows that are, if you will, anti-war. It's amazing, the topics, because most of the topics are so relevant today, we still haven't learned our lessons. I saw an episode that was a Thanksgiving episode. And, of course, Northern Exposure in their little town, their fictitious town, I think, of Sisley, Alaska. They have various celebrations at different holiday times that are different than we would expect. There's a combination of Native American traditions and just some Alaskan traditions, too, tossed into what we normally would think of. And one interesting thing that they showed, which I don't believe is true at all, is that on Thanksgiving there in Sisley, Alaska, white people, and you know who you are, white people find that they get thrown tomatoes at them, squishy tomatoes, in the celebration for Thanksgiving. And who throws the tomatoes? The Native Americans, of course. Why? Because of what we did to them. It was their country, the whole of North America. And white people came and cheated and stole and killed and lied and took it over. And so with very good nature, though, in this episode of Northern Exposure, the white people in Sicily expect to get tomatoes thrown at them at this time. And they laugh it off because it's a nonviolent way. You know, it's not, they're not shooting at them, but it's a way to show their historical disenfranchisement. And it's certainly true. And I'm not going to read it because it's a little too inflammatory, but Howard Zinn passed away a couple years ago. He was a historian, and he's famous for a best-selling book that was used in textbook in some colleges, but not in high schools because it was too radical. It was called A People's History of the United States, and it was facts about the history of the U.S. that aren't mentioned hardly at all in mainstream history. And he said a few years ago about July 4th that nationalism and its symbols are bad. The flag, pledges of allegiance, the anthems, its insistence in song that God must single out America to be blessed. And he believes that that devotion to a flag, an anthem, a boundary, so fierce, it engenders mass murder. And he thought, he's not around anymore, one of the great evils of our time, along with racism, along with religious hatred, too, which is a separate issue. But we didn't do too well. So I thought Northern Exposure, interesting way to bring that about. And, of course, the doctor, one of the lead characters of Northern Exposure, a fictional city again, Joel Fleischman, he's Jewish. And the only Jewish person in Alaska. He found a couple more in another episode, but... And so he got a tomato and thrown at him in the beginning, and he didn't know what the tradition was of the Native Americans doing that, so he was very upset. But then he finally told them, he had to tell them, look, I'm not white, okay? I'm from a people, Jewish people. Historically, we've been disenfranchised for centuries and herded into small communities as well as, during World War II, of course, the Holocaust. And so the Native Americans listened, and they understood that he wasn't part of that tradition. His people, if you will, also had oppression and disenfranchisement. So they didn't throw tomatoes at him anymore. So, but I thought that was an interesting way to celebrate some holidays. You have to understand the big picture in whatever you're doing. Anytime you accept a generalization of the masses, you got to be a little suspicious that something's not coming right. Well, in 3 minutes, guess what? It's Kitty Love with Highway 61, the best in the blues, coming up for you. 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock today. At 4 o'clock, Mike Holloway came in, and I guess he didn't take a 4th of July vacation, so his show is pre-recorded. And it's in the computer, and Kitty Love will start that up for you. But he made a special effort to come in on what day? July 4th, he was here in the studios in our second, number two studio, doing a pre-recorded show for you. So it's going to be great. It's recent. It's not repeated from years ago or anything like that. So that's going to be very great entertainment, too. And that's Go With The Flow from 4 to 6 p.m. Let me see what else is sitting on my desk here the last couple minutes. Okay, just a comment here. From New York Times editorial writer, basically a Republican, but he's moderate Republican, not like any of the Republicans in Congress. His name is David Brooks. He's also a commentator on public broadcasting news, too, as their number one Republican. He has an editorial comment about how we miseducate youth these days. And he thinks that, we don't teach youth what they really need to know. And he's not talking about technology or vocational training towards one single job. He's talking about the bigger picture, the bigger questions that he thinks every teacher should incorporate into their classes. And let me just read the paragraph, and I'll read you my response here. I'd say colleges have to do more to put certain questions on the table to help students grapple with the uncertainty. Number one, what does it mean to be an adult today? Number two, what are 7 or 10 ways that people have found purpose in life? Number three, how big should I dream or how realistic should I be? Number four, what are the criteria we should think about before shacking up? He's kind of an older guy and calls it shacking up. Okay. Establishing a solid live-in relationship, sexual relationship with someone else, for those that don't know the term. Okay. Next, what are we up five or six? What is the cure for sadness? Okay, a lot of people say, I'm sad, I'm depressed. What do you do? Drink yourself silly? How can you overcome that? A little sadness, I'd like to suggest, is part of life every day. I find it a motivating factor myself for doing good things. David Brooks suggests, what do I want and what is truly worth wanting? Notice he didn't say, what do I need? That should be evident already. But what is it that you want and what is truly worth wanting? Now, I made a list here. First of all, here's some great classes to take at Henry Ford College or elsewhere. World religions. The only problem I have with world religions is it doesn't teach how to be a secular humanist at the same time, because you don't have to have a religion. I'm sorry. It is true, if you have an open mind, that you do not need religion to be a good person. You don't need to be part of any organized religion. That's my opinion only. Now, many world religions do touch on that, because that is not just the, you know, a totally opposite amoral option, but it's something that's good. Of course, every class in English literature and American literature, read the novels, the short story, the poems, talk about the values. And if they're still appropriate today, political science, civics classes of any sort let you know about how you can be part of society and make a difference. Sociology, how you can work within different groups in society. Philosophy, oh my gosh, philosophy classes, especially ethics classes, and the history of philosophy, that really will set you up pretty well. And of course, psychology too, and history. But it's got to be full range history, in-depth history, not just that gloss over the top kind of history. And the three classes we don't do enough of in college or anywhere, sex education, health and nutrition, okay, the latest on health and nutrition, and personal finance. They don't do that. Nope. Okay. You'd like me to make a special announcement?
If that kind of goes hand in hand.
Sure. Well, just, you know, if you are here on campus, you can walk into our career services people, and I think they will help almost anybody, including students here, but especially students here, and they'll give you assistance and counseling and how to find a job, job resumes, interviews, general job searches, and we even post a biweekly job list at the HFC Career Service office. It's in Building A, room 117. Ooh, Building A. Where is that anyway? I don't know. But somewhere on campus. Yes, we're here at Henry Ford College. This is WHFR. Dear Warren, thank you for listening today. Hope I've challenged your thinking a little bit about one thing or something else. Keep up the struggle. Keep going forward. And we'll catch you next week. Take care. And.